This lecture is produced by Stone Kingdom Ministries of Asheville, North Carolina. Follow along in your Bible as James Brueggemann shares good news from God's Word. For a sample copy of our publication and a catalog of the resources available, write to Stone Kingdom Ministries, Post Office Box 5695, Asheville, North Carolina, zip code 28813. You may also visit us on the web at www.stonekingdom.org. Your regular financial support is what makes this ministry possible, and we are grateful to you for that. And now, here is Bible teacher James Brueggemann.
Turn to 2 Samuel chapter 13. We left off last time with the very tragic fall of David into the sins of adultery and murder. In 2 Samuel 13, we find the very first words of this chapter are, "And it came to pass after this." As is typical of the Bible, huge chunks of time are passed over without a word, so that certain incidents can be dealt with in great detail. And so we need to realize that many years must have passed now between the affair of David and Bathsheba and subsequent death of their firstborn son. We'll see that by the time we get finished with today's story, some of David's children are adults and have children of their own. Verse 1, "And it came to pass after this that Absalom, the son of David, had a fair," which means lovely, "sister, whose name was Tamar, and Amnon, the son of David, loved her." All right, you see I've already put on the whiteboard up here a little semi-genealogy of David's family because we want to keep the character straight. So David here is in the middle. The double lines mean husband-wife relationship. So he's married to Maacah, one of his wives, and from that marriage comes the son Absalom and the daughter Tamar. And then it says in the verse, Amnon, the son of David. But Amnon's over here. He's the son of the wife Ahinoam. So this will be very important as we continue. We've already encountered some of these people in previous studies in the life of David. You don't need to turn there, but remember this verse, 2 Samuel 3, verse 3. "And his second," and I'm going to substitute the word or add the word son. This is talking about David's sons and his wives. "And his second son, Chileab," or Chileab, over here, "of Abigail, the wife of Nabal the Carmelite, and third," in other words, the third son, "Absalom, the son of Maacah, the daughter of Talmai, king of Geshur." So Chileab, or Chileab, is the second-born son. Amnon is the first-born. And Absalom is the third-born son. Incidentally, the name Amnon literally means faithful. And sometimes people fulfill their names, and other times they do not. We cannot discern the exact ages of the players here, but Amnon, Absalom, and Tamar are evidently adults, perhaps young adults, all unmarried. Now notice the very first name in this story is Absalom. That's appropriate because although this first chapter deals with the rape of Tamar by Amnon, the next seven chapters are really focused on Absalom, the third-born son of David. You'll recall from our last lecture that after David had seen to it that Uriah the Hittite was killed, that Nathan prophesied to David that God would raise up evil against David out of his own family, and that since he, David, had taken another man's wife secretly, that, quote, a neighbor, end quote, of his would lie with David's wives in broad daylight. This neighbor is none other than Absalom, David's own son. And that's the reason why Absalom is taking center stage for the next seven chapters, because this is the means by which God is bringing this prophecy to pass in judgment upon David for his transgressions. But the event which triggers this whole series of events is the rape of Absalom's sister Tamar. Now, to better understand certain parts of this story, let me apprise you of some of the customs of the day in the ancient Mideast. First of all, the unmarried virgin daughters of the monarch were kept on a very tight leash, so to speak. They were kept in virtual seclusion from the company of men. No strangers were allowed, nor even relatives of the opposite sex, unless there were witnesses present. The sad truth is that one of the reasons these daughters were so closely guarded and protected was not so much for religious or virtuous reasons, but because of their political value. I remind you that princesses were used to cement relationships with foreign nations by having the princess marry a prince of a foreign nation. Of course, if the princess lost her virginity before marriage, she was useless as a political tool or political commodity. Now, I know that sounds cold and ruthless and grossly unfair to women, and it is abhorrent to us that they were used as a political tool, but those were the political facts of life in those days. Think it's any different? Yeah, I heard you say that. It still is, right? But in recent years, with the spate of television documentaries on the plight of women in Muslim countries, for example, we've learned that many of these customs, which are degrading of women, still prevail. For example, years ago, none of us had ever heard the word burqa, right? But I would guess that somebody here now knows what a burqa is. Yes. It's that big, long, black garment that the women in the Muslim countries wear that covers them from head to foot, and they got, you know, just a little two square inches around their eyeballs, and that's all you can see, practically. Incidentally, as we were saying, political marriages have really never ceased. They've simply moved, at least in America, to a higher level of sophistication. I'm thinking of some interesting alliances in the political, money, and media worlds. For example, I think it's NBC news reporter Andrea Mitchell. Do you know who she's married to? Alan Greenspan, chairman of the Federal Reserve. How interesting. I bet she reports without any bias on the money issues of the day. Another one, Democratic Party spin doctor James Carville is married to Bush 41 campaign chairman Mary Madeline, who's now on the staff of Vice President Cheney. Boy, I'll bet they have some interesting dinner conversations. And Diane Sawyer is married to film director Mike Nichols. And he's done a lot of films, but the only one I could think of was way back, one of his earlier ones, Bob and Carol and Ted and Alice, which if I recall was about, I didn't see it, but I heard it was about wife swapping. I don't know for sure. By the way, his real name is not Mike Nichols. It's Michael Igor Pachowski. And he escaped Nazi Germany just in time. Good Lutheran, you might imagine. Turning back to our story, despite all the protections surrounding a princess, Prince Amnon, as the firstborn and the heir apparent to David's throne, obviously had been in the presence of Tamar many times because he had developed such a violent passion for her. So 2 Samuel 13:2 says, "And Amnon was so vexed that he fell sick for his sister Tamar." That is, Amnon was frustrated to the point of illness. What was he so frustrated about? Well, the text continues, "For she was a virgin, and Amnon thought it hard," says in the King James, the marginal says, "Amnon saw that it was improper for him to do anything to her." To be blunt, he wanted to sleep with her, to lie with her, but he knew it was wrong, and yet he could not stop pondering the idea. Enter Jonadab from stage left. He's up here in the upper right corner. "And Amnon had a friend whose name was Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother. And Jonadab was a very subtle," which means crafty, "man." Shimeah, also known as Shammah, was David's brother. That would make Jonadab what to David? His nephew. And first cousin to Amnon, right? So he was his best friend and first cousin. And he comes to him and says, verse 4, "And he said unto him, Why art thou, being the king's son, lean from day to day? Wilt thou not tell me?" Let's pause here. Jonadab is puzzled by Amnon's appearance. He's thinking or saying, "My dear cousin Amnon, being a prince in Israel, you surely don't have trouble buying groceries. I mean, there's always enough food in your house. Why in the world are you looking so thin and gaunt?" The verse continues, "And Amnon said unto him, I love Tamar, my brother Absalom's sister." He loves Tamar. Really? Was it love, or was it more specifically love of the lust variety? As you know, our English word love carries a variety of meanings and connotations, and the same in Hebrew. Here's just part of the definition for this Hebrew word. To love, human love for another, includes family love, sexual love, human appetite for objects such as sleep, food, drink, wisdom, human love for or to God, the act of being a friend, lovers, figuratively, of adulterers, and it means to like. Same as in English, right? All those connotations. By the way, the word in Hebrew for love here is Ahab, as in Captain Ahab of Herman Melville's Moby Dick. This, however, is not the same Hebrew word as the name of the notorious later king of Israel named King Ahab. That's in Hebrew, Ahab. It's not the same word. Now, I suspect that Melville probably named Captain Ahab after King Ahab, not after the word love. Let's turn back now to Leviticus. Keep a marker here for the rest of the day, for both messages today. It's our base of operations, as it were. But we're going back to the law, to Leviticus 18, to review the pertinent laws which are coming into play at this point. Leviticus 18, verse 9. The nakedness of thy sister, the daughter of thy father, or the daughter of thy mother, whether she be born at home or born abroad, even their nakedness thou shalt not uncover. And we've commented on this before, but for the sake of new people here on the Tate Ministry, we point out that the phrase, to uncover the nakedness of, is a Hebrew idiom which means to have sex with. And notice also that the Bible is very clear here to cover the case of half-brothers and half-sisters, like Amnon and Tamar. And that's why it at first appears redundant for verse 9 to say, the daughter of thy father or daughter of thy mother. But it's not a redundancy. In an ideal family, the daughter of the father is also the daughter of the mother. But not when one or the other parent has been divorced or widowed and remarried, or as in the case here, where there are multiple wives. But the law is clear. Having sex with your sister or half-sister is incest. It is forbidden. Now, verse 10 is not related to our discussion here today, but verse 11 is. The nakedness of thy father's wife's daughter, begotten of thy father, she is thy sister, thou shalt not uncover her nakedness. A little complicated sounding. Let's parse this sentence. And let's each of us put ourselves into the sentence to see it more clearly. Where it says thy, that's you or me. And so it speaks of your father's wife's daughter. You'd think, well, that's my sister. Well, if we just stop there, it's clearly inferred that your father's wife is not your mother. Now, polygamy is virtually unheard of in America today, but blended families are very common. A blended family is where parents have divorced and remarried, and then the new family may have children from both of the partners in the second marriage, plus children of their own together. So, for example, and I've pre-diagrammed this also, and I've got a handout to cover all this, but that's for later reference. We'll send that out with the tape. But look up here while I'm doing this. We've got mom and dad. And this is the second marriage for each of them, okay? They're both divorced and they've married each other here, so it's their second marriage. Dad has a boy and a girl from his first marriage. Mom has a boy and a girl from her first marriage. They come together, they got two boys and two girls. It's a blended family, right? What's the relationship between dad's boy and girl and mom's boy and girl? These are what? Yeah, they're step. That's the step. Siblings, that's a good word, covers them all. Step-brother, step-sister. Important point is step. Now, this dad and mom in the second marriage, they get together and they have a baby girl. And she, the baby girl, how is she related to dad's boy and girl? That's half. It's not a step. That's very important. It's a half-sibling, half-brother, half-sister. And the same on the other side, to mom's boy and girl. It's a half-brother or half-sister relationship, not a step-brother, step-sister. Let's look first at the step-brother, step-sister relationship. Take dad's boy from the first marriage and mom's girl from her first marriage. They are step-brother-sister, aren't they? Can they marry according to God's law here? Yes, they can. Stepbrothers and sisters can marry because there's no identical blood. Genes, yeah. Okay. Now continuing to parse verse 11, let's read that again. The nakedness of your father's wife's daughter begotten of thy father. Now, so that's the situation we've just described here as the half-sibling relationship, right? Half-brother, half-sister, not step. So according to God's law here, if you are the boy from the father's first marriage, can you marry your half-sister, this girl? Absolutely not. That is incest. And that's what the verse says. She is thy sister, technically half-sister. You shall not uncover her nakedness. You shall not have sex with her or marry her. Does everyone understand this? Are there any questions? Now turn over to Leviticus 20, verse 17, where we find a similar statute, plus the judgment for the violation of the law. 20:17. And if a man shall take his sister, his father's daughter, or his mother's daughter, and see her nakedness, and she see his nakedness, same as uncover, in other words, have sex with, it is a wicked thing, and they shall be cut off in the sight of their people. He hath uncovered his sister's nakedness, he shall bear his iniquity. Now, there is some debate as to the penalty for this sin. The debate revolves around the question, does cut off mean to execute or to send into exile? And there's good debate on, or good points on both sides, and we're not going to get into that nitty-gritty stuff right here. But let's get back to Amnon and Tamar. And I'll take the blended family diagram down so that you can see the original here, or refer to the handout. Amnon and Tamar, what were they? Half or step? Half. Half-brother, half-sister. According to God's law, could they marry or have sex? No, that's incest. Now let's continue in 2 Samuel 13, verse 5, where Jonadab has concocted a cunning plan to help his cousin fulfill his unlawful desire. And Jonadab said unto him, lay thee down on thy bed and make thyself sick, and when thy father cometh to see thee, say unto him, I pray thee, let my sister Tamar come and give me meat and dress the meat in my sight that I may see it and eat it at her hand. So Amnon lay down and made himself sick. And when the king was come to see him, Amnon said unto the king, I pray thee, let Tamar my sister come and make me a couple of cakes in my sight that I may eat at her hand. Now when it says that Amnon made himself sick, it doesn't mean he went bulimic or stuck his finger down his throat or anything like that. It means he pretended to be sick, and obviously it helped that he was already looking kind of thin and pale. But obviously it couldn't have been a stomach sickness, or else he'd have no reason to request food. Then David sent home to Tamar, saying, go now to thy brother Amnon's house and dress him meat. So notice the further cleverness of the plan in Amnon not sending for Tamar himself directly, but in persuading his father, the king, and to send Tamar to him. She couldn't refuse his summons. Verse 8, so Tamar went to her brother Amnon's house, and he was laid down. And she took flour and kneaded it and made cakes in his sight and did bake the cakes. And she took a pan and poured them out before him, but he refused to eat. And Amnon said, have out all the men from me. And they went out every man from him. And Amnon said unto Tamar, now she was in an outer room cooking, and he was in the bedroom. And he says, bring the meat, or the food means, bring the food into the chamber that I may eat of thine hand. And Tamar took the cakes which she had made and brought them into the chamber to Amnon her brother. And when she had brought them unto him to eat, he took hold of her and said unto her, come lie with me, my sister. So Amnon is now seeking to do this evil, but Tamar resists. And she answered him, nay, my brother, do not force me, for no such thing ought to be done in Israel. Do not thou this folly. Hold your place here, turn to Genesis 34. So here the frightened Tamar is actually, by saying that, quoting almost verbatim from Genesis 34, verse 7. And it's a reference to the rape of Jacob's daughter Dinah by a Canaanite prince. And I'm going to begin reading in Genesis 34 and verse 1. And Dinah, the daughter of Leah, which she bare unto Jacob, went out to see the daughters of the land. And when Shechem, the son of Hamor, the Hivite, prince of the country, saw her, he took her and lay with her and defiled her. Drop down to verse 7. And the sons of Jacob came out of the field when they heard it, and the men were grieved, and they were very wroth, because he had wrought folly in Israel in lying with Jacob's daughter, which thing ought not to be done. So here is Tamar, back in 2 Samuel again, here is Tamar appealing to Prince Amnon not to do such a despicable thing like the Canaanite prince did to Dinah. In other words, she was quoting scripture to him. But that didn't stop Amnon. He was obsessed. He continues his advances upon Tamar, and she continues her pleading. Verse 13, And I, whither shall I cause my shame to go? And as for thee, thou shalt be as one of the fools in Israel. Now therefore, I pray thee, speak unto the king, for he will not withhold me from thee. What she appears to be saying here is, look, if you want me so badly, let's get married. Let's go about this thing the right way. Go ask our father for permission. I'm sure he will approve. Think so? Well, this was no doubt her last-ditch attempt to stave off the rape. He knew as well as she did that David would not approve an incestuous marriage. 14. Howbeit, he would not hearken unto her voice, but being stronger than she, forced her and lay with her. Then Amnon hated her exceedingly, so that the hatred wherewith he hated her was greater than the love wherewith he had loved her. And Amnon said unto her, Arise, be gone. And she said unto him, There is no cause, there's no reason for me to be gone now. In other words, this evil in sending me away is greater than the other that thou didst unto me. But he would not hearken unto her. Why would she say that? I think what she was referring to now was, all right, you've already spoiled me. We may as well do like the heathen do in the countries round about, where it was very common for this type of incest to occur, where the heathen nations, the princes, often married their sisters. I mean, it was common. So she was, because her alternative was, she's now, quote unquote, spoiled goods as a political commodity. Her destiny was to be like a widow the rest of her life. And she said, you know, I'd rather just be your wife now. But that wasn't to be. 17. Then he called his servant that ministered unto him, and said, Put now this woman out from me, and bolt the door after her. The reaction of Amnon after the rape reminds me of the saying, which is now practically immortalized in film and drama. You know the scene where, as a man is attempting to seduce a woman for a, quote, one-night stand. I mean, that's the way he looks at it, sex and nothing more. But from the woman's point of view, she wants and needs more, and so in response to his request for sex tonight, right now, she says, Will you still love me in the morning? In other words, the woman is concerned that after the man fulfills his desire, he will discard her. He will have simply used her. Will you still love me in the morning? Amnon's reaction of violent hatred is further proof that his action was motivated only by selfish lust and not true love. Because true love always has the best interests of the other party in mind. The Bible says in Paul's letter to the Corinthians, love never faileth. In other words, love doesn't disappear in the morning. Love is goodness in action towards another person indefinitely. Amnon's hatred for Tamar also illustrates the common human trait of hating the one whom you have injured. I say it's a common human trait. It's common for those of low character. But we all hurt others from time to time. And for the Christian, for the person who is spiritually growing, he or she learns to make restitution to and to seek forgiveness from the one whom we have injured. Amnon's selfishness and passion led him into an act of incestuous rape. But after the deed was done, he despised her, not for any wickedness in her, but because her mere presence now exacerbated his own guilt, his remorse, his shame, I say probable remorse, for that atrocious deed. And undoubtedly, her mere presence amplified his fear of being discovered and punished. Verse 18, and she had a garment of diverse colors upon her, for with such robes were the king's daughters that were virgins appareled. And again, we must understand the custom of the day. In modern America, clothing is incredibly inexpensive. But in those days, it was all made by hand, and only the ladies of highest station could have the luxury to wear, to have fancy embroidered robes or tunics, and that's what the multicolored is. They say it means nice embroidered colored pictures woven into the robes and tunics. You know, ordinary women were far too busy working on the necessities of everyday life. And so the multicolored tunic was a mark of high distinction and class and wealth. Continuing, then his servant brought her out and bolted the door after her. Now again, the custom of the day would have had a servant standing at the door. And the bolt was almost never necessary to be locked. But you see, Amnon ordered it to be locked to make it appear that she was the guilty one, like Potiphar's wife trying to seduce Joseph. And so in order to protect himself from her, he had to get her out of the room and bolt the door so she couldn't get back in to try to seduce him. 19, and Tamar put ashes on her head and rent her garment of diverse colors that was on her and laid her hand on her head and went on crying. Since the veil which the princess always wore is not mentioned here, it's probable that Amnon sent her away without it. And therefore, she put her hands on her head in an attempt to comply, to cover her head like women were supposed to do. And she goes to Absalom, her full brother's house. Verse 20, and Absalom, her brother, said unto her, hath Amnon thy brother been with thee? You know, Absalom didn't need to be a genius to figure out what had happened. The virgin daughters of the king wore that distinctive multicolored tunic, and here comes his sister with ashes of mourning on her head, weeping, having her garment deliberately ripped. Tamar, no doubt, nodded yes to his question. And now listen to this seemingly strange reaction of Absalom as we continue in verse 20. He says to her, after he knows that she's been raped, but now hold thy peace, my sister. He is thy brother. Regard not this thing. So Tamar remained desolate in her brother Absalom's house. This young woman needed sympathy. This grave injustice had just been perpetrated upon her, and all Absalom can say is, hold your peace, my sister. He is your brother. Regard not this thing. I mean, that's like saying, now, don't go getting angry about it, sis. After all, he is your brother. Don't go making a big deal about it. Isn't that the sense you get from that? That's really weird, but keep that in mind as we proceed, because there is a method to Absalom's weirdness here. This phrase that Tamar remained desolate in her brother's house is okay, I suppose. It paints for us a picture of a woman devastated, deserted, and ravaged by this event. And those words are all other possible translations for the Hebrew word here translated desolate. But there is another possibility, which I think seems to fit even better, given that she'd just been raped. Because the Hebrew word is Strong's 8074, it's shamem, and it could have been rendered deflowered. It speaks of the flower of her virginity having been plucked and taken in a shameful way. Tamar was deflowered and lived in shame in her brother Absalom's house. Well, why did she live in Absalom's house instead of with her daddy? Or why didn't they all live in one big house? Well, this is another custom of the ancient East, where polygamy was and still is common. The full brother often became the guardian and special protector of the interests and honor of his sisters, of his full sisters. When a man had numerous children from many wives, it seems like he delegated these duties to the various elder brothers. Verse 21, and when King David heard of all these things, he was very wroth. And Absalom spake unto his brother Amnon, neither good nor bad. For Absalom hated Amnon because he had forced his sister Tamar. Let's notice the contrast between the reactions of David and that of Absalom. David showed his hot anger openly and immediately. You can see him livid with wrath as he's striding about his palatial home, shouting in anguish to his courtiers and other family members that might be there, "Oh God, no! Oh God, why Tamar? Why Amnon? Why have you done this to me, God? Why?" And you know, as soon as the words left his lips, he instantly knew why these things had happened. It was a result of his own sins with Bathsheba and the murder of Uriah. They were coming back to haunt him. It was God's pronouncement of judgment through the prophet Nathan now coming to pass. Oh, the pain, he thought to himself. Such prolonged tragedy, lifetime of tragedy for Tamar, all because of a few moments of pleasure with Bathsheba. What a fool I was. David wept. He moaned. He groaned. He cried out in intense emotional pain. He screamed in anger at Amnon. But perhaps that's all he did. The record gives us no indication that David moved in any way to punish Amnon. Perhaps he did, and it's simply not recorded. We'll conjecture about that later. But David was obviously compromised by his own sins in the Bathsheba affair, so that he felt he couldn't really do much about what Amnon had just done. Absalom, on the other hand, was seething inside with hot anger and hatred. He did not let it show for a moment. He must have been one cool customer, because even as he was learning the truth when Tamar came back with her ripped robe, he had immediately suppressed his anger and hatred toward Amnon. And that's why he said to her, "Oh, don't worry about it. He's your brother." What a cool customer, already raging inside and yet not even wanting to let her know of the plot that he was already setting in motion in his mind. He certainly showed a poker face to Amnon, didn't he? He didn't speak a word about the incident to Amnon. He carried on a normal relationship with him, acting as though nothing had happened. And that, of course, was to deceive Amnon into thinking that perhaps he'd gotten away with it. Now, notice again, who's the firstborn son of David? It's Amnon. He's the heir apparent to the throne. And after mentioning the birth of Chileab back in whatever it was, early in 2 Samuel, the Bible doesn't say any more about the secondborn son. Nothing's ever heard of him again, and scholars infer that he died very young or in his youth somewhere. He was out of the line for the throne. And if that were so, then it becomes very clear that Absalom, being the third-born son, is thinking, if I can get Amnon out of the way, then I'm next in line for the throne. Consequently, Absalom was very sly in concealing his boiling hatred for Amnon. He displayed a poker face to Amnon and to everyone else for a very long time, as we read in the next verse. 23. And it came to pass, after 2 full years, that Absalom had sheep shearers in Baal Hazor, which is beside Ephraim, and Absalom invited all the king's sons. Incidentally, does that sheep shearing remind you of anything else? Think about that. We'll come back to it in part two. But Absalom had a ranching business, obviously. He didn't just sit around the castle all day. But he had sheep, and so this was the time for the sheep shearing. And it was up about, this Baal Hazor was about 8 miles northeast of Jerusalem. And so what happened at this time of year when they had the sheep shearing was, well, Absalom didn't get his hands dirty, probably. He had all his servants do the actual sheep shearing, but they had big sheep shearing parties. And so he goes to the king, verse 24, Absalom came to the king and said, "Behold now, thy servant," meaning himself, "hath sheep shearers. Let the king, I beseech thee, and his servants go with thy servant." Let's set aside the royal English here for a moment. Absalom is simply asking his father to come to his big sheep shearing party and bring all your courtiers with you. And the king said to Absalom, "Nay, my son, let us not all now go, lest we be chargeable unto thee." And he pressed him, howbeit he would not go, but blessed him. Absalom's playing the proper political protocol game here. He's making every effort to appear wholly sincere in desiring to have his father and the whole court come to the sheep shearing feast. But I wonder if with the revenge that he has in mind, whether Absalom really wanted his father present. But of course, you have to ask the king, your dad, to come. The protocol, the royal etiquette demanded that he invite him. David, however, not wishing to put an enormous financial burden on Absalom for the expenses of his entire entourage, declined with grace. 26. Then said Absalom, "Well, if not, I pray thee, let thy brother Amnon go with us, or let my brother Amnon go with us." And the king said unto him, "Why should he go with thee?" Do you think he might be a little suspicious? 27. But Absalom pressed him, and that he let Amnon and all the king's sons go with him. 28. Now Absalom had commanded his servants, saying, "Mark ye now when Amnon's heart is merry with wine, and when I say unto you, smite Amnon, then kill him. Fear not, have not I commanded you? Be courageous and valiant." In other words, you guys just do what I say. I'm taking responsibility here. 29. And the servants of Absalom did unto Amnon as Absalom had commanded. Then all the king's sons arose, and every man gat him up upon his mule and fled. You can picture the scene. A huge feast. Plenty of food, lots of wine flowing, lots of drinking going on, lots of mirth and merriment and entertainment of one sort or another. Suddenly, several servants surround Amnon, who is pretty tipsy, and they plunge their daggers into him. The other princes, perhaps half-soused themselves, quickly sobered to the point where they realized that Absalom may be intending a general massacre of all the king's sons here, and so they, to eliminate all the competition, and so they mount their mules and they hightail it down the highway back towards Jerusalem. And we might find the picture of these princes on their mules rather humorous, but we've got to realize this was the standard conveyance of royalty in those days, and these were so-called Syrian mules, and they were of a much higher quality and strength and speed than the thing we'd see out in a farm or a barnyard today. It was a different, little different animal. And if you want to look it up later, you'll find in 1 Kings 1, verse 33, that David himself had his own royal mule. So in the confusion and the tumult which ensued after the assassination, the news reached Jerusalem and reached the king's ears quickly. 30. And it came to pass, while they were in the way, that tidings came to David, saying, "Absalom hath slain all the king's sons, and there is not one of them left." Rumors were flying everywhere. And this seems to be typical of mankind in general. Anytime there's a major tragedy, all kinds of versions of the story start floating about, especially nowadays with the internet. Remember the 911 tragedy? I mean, who could ever sort it out, what the truth is? Well, when the news came that all of his sons were dead, David believed the worst. And this possibility that they were all massacred is not at all unheard of. In many a nation that has hereditary rulership, one claimant to the throne will often seek to slay all his competition. There's more than one example of that in the Bible. And for example, the one that came to my mind first was back in Judges 9, where after the death of Gideon, Gideon had 70 sons, numerous wives, 70 sons. And there was one, Abimelech, I think, or Ahimelech, who slew all the rest, except one, the youngest, Jotham, who escaped. He slew 68 of his brothers. I guess we could say that the lesson in being a son of the king is that it's a dangerous job. Are you the son of a king or daughter? Then I want you to be aware that your greatest enemies just might be your own brethren. Do you see an application to the Saul church? We'll come back to that in part two of the message. 31. Then the king arose and tore his garments and lay on the earth, and all his servants stood by with their clothes rent. Then, my oh my, look who stops by the palace to set the record straight. Why, it's that instigator of Amnon's scheme in the first place. It's cousin Jonadab, the nephew of the king. And Jonadab, the son of Shimeah, David's brother, answered and said, "Let not my lord suppose that they have slain all the young men, the king's sons, for Amnon only is dead. For by the appointment of Absalom, this hath been determined from the day that he forced his sister Tamar." How did Jonadab know that? Now, I'm just guessing here, but it seems to me that cousin Jonadab seems to have had a backstage pass. I mean, he seems to be in the know about everything. Do you think he's a backstage manipulator, perhaps? Do you think he knew in advance of Absalom's plan? I think so. Jonadab continues speaking to King David, 33. "Now therefore, let not my lord the king take the thing to his heart to think that all the king's sons are dead, for Amnon only is dead. 34. But Absalom fled." And as Defense Secretary Rumsfeld is wont to say, full stop. You ever heard him say that? Full stop, meaning end of thought. Because after that three-word sentence telling us that Absalom fled, the scene immediately shifts to Jerusalem, where David is anxiously awaiting confirmation, or not, of Jonadab's theory that only Amnon was killed. And it goes on now. "And the young man that kept the watch lifted up his eyes and looked, and behold, there came much people by the way of the hillside behind him. And Jonadab said unto the king, Behold, the king's sons come, as thy servant said, so it is. And it came to pass, as soon as he had made an end of speaking, that behold, the king's sons came, and lifted up their voice, and wept. And the king also, and all his servants, wept very sore. But Absalom fled, and went to Talmai, the son of Ammihud, king of Geshur. And David mourned for his son every day." Now, so that there's not confusion, let me tell you the way I read this. It may or may not be correct, but Absalom fled and went to Talmai, the king of Geshur. Talmai is the father of Maacah here. So when he fled to Talmai, king of Geshur, he was going to his grandpa's house on his mother's side. So he left the country of Israel, went north up into the land of the Geshurites. And it says David mourned for his son every day. Some people think it's Absalom. I think it's Amnon. He mourned for Amnon. Amnon was dead. "So Absalom fled and went to Geshur," 38, verse 38, "and was there 3 years." 39. Now, there's some time that's passed during this three-year period. Is now when 39 comes in. "And the soul of King David longed to go forth unto Absalom, for he was comforted concerning Amnon, seeing he was dead." In other words, during this three-year period of time, his great grief over the death of his firstborn Amnon had diminished. And so he didn't mourn for him so much anymore. He was comforted over that, but now he began to really miss Absalom. We're assuming Chileab is dead, the secondborn. And he knows Absalom is his firstborn, but he's away in exile for 3 years. And so David is really longing to see him, but he probably figures, but I can't do that. It was cold-blooded revenge murder. And thus ends Act 1 in today's drama. The surviving princes have returned to Jerusalem. The murderous Absalom, knowing that his premeditated murder would allow him no sanctuary in his own land, then flees for asylum to Talmai, like I said, who is his grandfather on his mother's side. And there he remained 3 years. And after the intermission, Act 2.